Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, supported this month by the Justice Brothers. We have our very special guest, my pal Pushy Loose, also known as Chris Simmons. Mr. Simmons, how are things in your world?
Things are good in my world. Everything's going well. I've got a weekend off coming up, which is pretty welcome this time of year. So, we're looking forward to, five more races this season, and so far so good.
It's got a couple of fun things to get into today. You're coming home from a test at Mid-Ohio where I believe 11 cars, approximately half the grid, spent their Tuesday. We also have the announcement of WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca coming back onto the schedule. Obviously, we have the Toronto race last weekend. I don't know if you heard about that one. Some Kiwi guy apparently did okay. And then we learned this morning, unfortunately, of Mo Nunn's passing. So we have some good items to get into and also one sad one before we get into Q&A. Before we get into all that, as we have been saying all month long, we're incredibly thankful for the Justice Brothers stepping in to support our existing efforts with Cooper Tires. It's been with us for the year. Justice Brothers are looking to hopefully expand their sales and distribution team. Have told me to let the world know that if you do have an interest in selling their additives, lubricants, and cleaners in the automotive, semi-truck, agricultural, and industrial markets, you can check out their website, justicebrothers.com. There's plenty of information there on how to join the team. Another fun thing, Chris, which is even closer to home, is our friends at Toronto Motorsports, the ones who've been doing the cool cartoon stickers and characters and figures and t-shirts and you name it. They've also been supporting us here in the podcast for a good while. They've come up with a fun little code, a discount code. So if you want to go to torontomotorsports.com and use the code INDY, all capital letters, Marshall Pruitt Podcast listeners can save 25% on all IndyCar related merchandise. That does expire on July 28th, and it is exclusive to you all, dear listeners. So you got about 10 days to act on that. Again, code is uppercase INDY, I-N-D-Y, and that applies to everything. Diecast, shirts, ball cap, stickers, mugs, and, you know, they're doing good things up there in Toronto Motorsports. So as someone who has stuck their stickers on plenty of things, I firmly appreciate everything they're doing. Chris, let's start off with last weekend in Toronto. Boy, I definitely thought that number 9 Chip Ganassi Racing Honda was going to be on pole. And then that Newgarden guy does what he has started to make a habit of, and that's pull one out and surprise folks a little bit. Tell me about the weekend leading up to qualifying where it looked like you guys were going to be on pole, and then a last-minute, last-lap surprise.
Well, Friday night, we were feeling pretty good about ourselves. You know, the two sessions has gone pretty good for us, and the Penske guys looked like they were struggling a little bit, and we thought, wow, maybe we can pick up some points this weekend. And then Saturday morning rolled around, and I guess those guys didn't go out to dinner. They just worked all night, and I'll have to see if maybe they broke garage hours or we can get them on that or something. But, yeah, they had their act together Saturday, and it wasn't just Newgarden. All three of the Penske's were much improved on Saturday. I don't think there was anything wrong with our car. We just, you know, it was difficult conditions and knowing when to go and when not to go and trying to be on track at the right time was difficult for everybody. I think the field was a bit jumbled up with the conditions and trying to chase the setup from wet to damp to dry. And yeah, we just, the track was at its best right at the end. And, by then our tires probably weren't as good as they should have been. And, Joseph, did a little bit better lap than Scott was able to do, but, he is making a habit of that. Makes our life difficult on a regular occasion.
So, let's talk a little bit about the challenges you are facing here. So you obviously have a driver, four-time champ, someone whose talents, you know, we no longer have to wax on about Dixon's talents. We know he's the best of his generation. You, and I think most engineers, will keep your head down, focus on what's in front of you with your car, with your team. But at the same time, Chris, as a former driver, Are you also someone who can look at the rivals you face and some of the unique challenges they pose and appreciate the fact that, yeah, you got one of the best of all time in the car that you're engineering, but you've also got some pretty steep talent you have to knock down in order to either get a pole or get the win?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of talent in the IndyCar series right now. I've been lucky enough to work with some of the best, especially the last few years of my career, with Dario and Tony and Scott. So it's been fun for me. But yeah, you look around and you got a Will Power, you got a Joseph Newgarden, you got a Pagano, you got a whole bunch of guys that are gunning for you every weekend, and you can't let up. It only takes a little tiny mistake, and instead of being first, you're seventh or tenth.
The race itself seemed to be one that I would say tasked drivers more heavily than most events this year, with going incredibly fast, pushing boundaries and limits, while having the ever-present possibility of crashing right in front of them. And it's not as if drivers aren't always, you know, at maximum attack, but it seemed like whether it was the changes in surface materials, something we've known about at Toronto for quite some time, but seemed like the combination of track surface quality, the reduction in downforce, heavy marbles going offline, seemed like the challenge on Sunday was to really try and execute something maybe a little bit harder than we see at many rounds. And everyone from Newgarden to Sato, I mean, whether it's champions to rookies, were hitting walls, crashing, doing all kinds of stuff, trying to stay on top of their cars. Tell us a little bit about what that was like from your vantage point, seeing that, hey, this isn't just a flat-out race, don't worry about it, go, go, go. It was, you're kind of balancing on the edge of a knife here.
Yeah, I mean, Toronto's always had a lot of surface changes, it's always given the track a lot of personality. I think it still does, even with the repaving. There's still concrete patches and some little bumps to deal with, nothing like what we had a few years ago, but the combination of that, it was quite hot even for a summer day in Toronto. The track temps and some of the corners were up to 120 degrees, so the combination of less downforce, a quite physical track, and I think because some of those bumps were smaller, guys were pushing the limits to the walls a little closer, and when there was a little mistake, there wasn't much margin for error. I think you saw that in the race, and it was certainly mixed up.
So we had, in your case, Dixie, who it looked like in the opening stint wasn't as happy as he'd hoped to be, switching on to the primary Firestones for the second stint, really seemed to bring the car to life, and getting up on Joseph's gearbox was then the next order of business. Tell me about just the challenges and also the changes of what you're hearing from Dix in terms of needs, and then also making those adjustments so not only he go after Newgarden even harder in that second stint, but I guess ultimately push him hard enough that we did see a mistake on a restart that opened up the door to victory.
Yeah, I mean, the beginning of the race, Scott got a pretty good start and had a decent run on Joseph down to turn three, but Joseph protected the inside, and Scott didn't want to take the risk around the outside, and he followed Joseph pretty close for the first third of that stint, and as any driver will tell you, even with a reduced downforce, there's still a lot of turbulence back there, and you're running even less downforce when you're following somebody, and following that close for a third of the stint was probably not doing our tires any good deeds.
Yeah.
So mid stint, he kind of backed off a bit to save the car a bit, and then the plan was to close back up for pit stops, but we just weren't close enough to really jump Joseph on the pit stops. Shortly after that, the yellow came out, and we thought the fight was on. We thought our car was pretty good, especially on blacks, and there was a lot of race to go, and we were hoping to get by. that wasn't that the pass the way it happened certainly wasn't in the plan, but we'll take it.
And let's talk about that for a sec. I mean, we, you know, in racing, whether it's from the timing stand as an engineer or, you know, sitting there as a mechanic, whatever, you're watching, you're hoping the good work you've put in to improve the car in whatever way is needed, the great talent of your driver, you're hoping that, of course, they pull off that daring pass into turn whatever, and the crowd rises to their feet and cheers. And then sometimes you see the guy you're chasing go wah, 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 and hit the wall before you even get to the green flag on the restart. What's going through your mind when you're watching that? Was it like, holy cow, or was it like, hey, thanks for the gift?
Well, it was right in front of our pits. You know, you often, on the restarts, we're watching the monitors more than we're really watching the racetrack, but you heard Joseph go, and then all of a sudden it got quiet, that quiet that you hear right before someone hits the wall. That kind of deafening quiet. We're like, did we just hear that? And then you heard him brush the wall and look up at the TV and sit down at the telemetry, and sure enough, that just happened. So it was a little incredulous, and then there was quite a big jam up behind him, and then all the craziness broke loose in turn one. So not something we were expecting. You know, it's something that it can be a risk. You have to be careful of things like that, even from a strategy standpoint. You can get yourself in trouble if you're saving fuel. I don't think this was the case with Joseph necessarily, but you know, if you're saving fuel and you don't have enough fuel to warm the tires up properly, you can put your driver into a situation like that. So you have to try to save the fuel early in a yellow. Make sure you tell your driver, hey, we're going green next time by. Start warming your tires and all that. So even under yellow, there's things to pay attention to.
And looking at how the race played out once Dixie got into the lead, I mean, there was a little bit of pressure there towards the end when he was wanting to get by Ryan Hunter-Reay, obviously. Pagenaud was, again, applying some pressure there, but it didn't seem like things were going to go particularly sideways. What was the mindset on pit lane of how you're trying to get to the finish line there? Were you feeding Dixie information about what was going on with, you know, Pagenaud creeping forward? Or is that the kind of thing at this stage where you don't really need to actively manage that for a veteran like this?
No, we're always trying to feed him information. And the most nervous part for us was really a few laps before that. When you're in the lead there, or anywhere up the front, really, it's hard to come in early because you drop yourself back into the pack where the cars are on older tires and are slower, and then the guys that are around you can go for the overcut. Conversely, if you stay out too long, and we've had this problem at Toronto before, you can get caught by a yellow and go right to the back. So we were in a really difficult spot there for a little while because we were going to come out in a not so great spot in traffic. But we knew guys at the back, or not even the back, guys throughout the field, you know, midfield on, some guys that had some pretty good cars, were going to start taking a chance on a yellow, pitting early in the window. So it's a worry, and we're monitoring those gaps live, full time, talking about it back and forth on timing stand. Myself, Mike, Scott Harner, Kate, Danielle, you know, all of us on the timing stand. We're talking about where we're going to come out, what fuel miles we need to get to the end, and all that. And then when Wickens pit, that gave us a bit of a gap to fall into, or a bit of a cushion to where we could come out behind somebody and still maintain the lead without someone overcutting us. And then we managed to get just enough gap to Hunter-Reay where we thought we could probably come out in front of him. And then we had a little bit of a slow stop and came out right behind him. So I can't even really say it was a slow stop by most team standards, but by the Wolfpack standards, it was a bit of a slow stop. And we knew it was going to be close anyway. We would have liked to have a bigger gap, but didn't want to take the risk on getting caught out by a yellow. So it, It was a little tense for a little bit there. Scott was wanting to get by Hunter Ray, make sure nobody was up behind him, and you know, we said, you know, just calm down, you got pace, take care of your tires, long way to the end. And luckily for a little while, the gap to Paginos had stabilized, and then I don't know if his tires came up or what, but he started closing that gap up, and Hunter Ray, you know, was at the end of his stint, so not going as fast as he had earlier, so that gap got down pretty low, and then we had a pretty good idea when Hunter Ray was gonna pit. He pulled off, and Scott was able to stretch that gap out to the end. So a little bit tense, but really the tensest spot was before we pit. Just always nervous about getting caught out by a yellow.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we look at the points and how things played out, Chris, you guys nearly doubled your haul of what you brought into the event. And we have tons of questions for you, so I don't want to get too far deep in some of the things that have been posed and whatnot, but it's not as if a 62-point lead with five rounds to go is something where you just kind of, you know, put your feet up and go, ah, all right, this is going to be easy. But is there any sense of, okay, that is a good number, we can manage that to get a title? Do you just put that out of your mind and pretend as if you know nothing about the standings? How do you use a good thing like 62-point lead over New Garden without it maybe distracting you?
Well, I think the only thing a 62-point lead tells us right now is that we'll come out of Mid-Ohio with a lead still.
Yeah.
Beyond that, it doesn't really tell us anything about how the rest of the season's going to go. And, you know, we tested at Mid-Ohio. Some of the other guys tested at Iowa. The Andretti guys are testing at Gateway. You know, some of those oval tracks where we're not testing, we expect Andretti and Penske to be strong. And, you know, even if we're on our A game, if they're a little better, that puts us eighth, so or ninth. It's not something you can rest on. You know, we had a pretty good lead with this fairly good driver named Dario Franchitti a few years ago.
And
he had a rocket ship at New Hampshire and had a little incident on a restart, and all of a sudden that point lead disappeared pretty rapidly. So with double points on offer the last race, the goal is to go in there with as big a cushion as possible. So if you do have an issue, you can still maintain that point lead. You know, we said a few weeks ago that we were going to have to win a couple more races at least to close this championship out. We got one, and we think we need at least one or two more. So that's going to be the goal of these last five races.
The nice thing, and this is one of the things, Chris, I don't believe fans understand how nice the Chip Ganassi Racing team is. And some of the other teams that were at Mid-Ohio yesterday, you guys helped out the track, make sure the barriers are working and functional, everything's good. I know Meyershank Racing's Jack Harvey joined in on the barrier assessment program and whatnot. So, you know, I mean, it's also, gosh, you guys just keep giving back to the community. I love that.
Yeah, you know, that's... I must have mistakenly wrote that on the test plan. forgot to take that off. So we'll revise that test plan for next year. But
nothing, yeah, nothing bad. Nothing that can't be fixed. Nothing to derail the momentum. Hopefully.
No, we had the car back together. We had to put it back together twice, unfortunately. And by we, I mean the guys. I pretty much stand there and watch these days. The track was difficult. Track's always difficult at Mid-Ohio. It takes a while for the grip to come up, and even with 11 cars, it takes a while. And we were kind of at the point where if you got off, you know, the line had some grip, and then if you got offline, there wasn't much. So it was real easy to make a mistake yesterday, and happened to both of our guys. It wasn't one of our finest tests, but luckily we had split the load between the cars and started at opposite ends of the list, so we didn't get everything done by any means, but we still got some good information, so we're looking forward to Mid-Ohio.
Should also mention here, dear listeners of the week in IndyCar, we're trying something new this week. Going to try it for a couple weeks, see how it pans out. Been asking folks, hey, what do you think? Longer podcast, shorter podcast for these weekly specials like this, and also the week in sports cars. And the response, honestly, was about 50-50. So going to try something new, and rather than put the entire episode into one long file, going to split up the conversation and insights and whatnot and the Q&A that's coming into two separate podcasts, and I'll structure them so that if you're listening from home or on whatever device, as you're hopefully listening to this, it'll finish, and then the next one coming up right after that will go straight into Q&A. So just a little bit of an adjustment, see if this makes a little bit more sense for folks or not, and if it doesn't, we'll just go back to one file. Let's talk about Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca, something, Chris, that I imagine you and I will probably always struggle to remember to put a sponsor's name in front of the track, because at least while we were growing up and going there in Indy Lights or whatever it was, it's just Laguna Seca. Share some thoughts about heading back to one of IndyCar's spiritual homes. It'll be our new season finale starting next year, and I guess like many of the tracks you go to, you're not just there making engineering calls as someone who only knows standing on pit lane. You're someone who's been to a lot of these tracks inside race cars up to and through Indy Lights.
Yeah, I did drive Indy Lights there at Laguna, beautiful part of the country, and, you know, like IndyCar has been able to do with a number of tracks lately, it's a place with a rich IndyCar history, and I like what the series is doing there. The places with that history are so fun to race at, and to look back at some of the names that have been successful there, and the fan base that you can draw from that are so passionate about IndyCar. It's fun to go to those places. Sad to see Sears Point or Infineon Raceway or
Sonoma Raceway or
any of its other names through the years go. They've been a great partner for IndyCar. We've had a lot of good races there, a lot of fun there. I know a lot of our sponsors have enjoyed going there for years, and it's, you know, another beautiful part of the country with passionate fans, and you know, maybe someday we'll be strong enough and can draw enough to support both tracks, and I'm hoping I'm around to see that day.
Yeah, we've got some more work going on behind the scenes, not exactly ready to say that they're going to happen, but there's definitely some work that is in action on the 2019 calendar. When I caught up with Mark Miles yesterday at the Laguna announcement, did mention that, you know, while he wasn't wanting to put names on it, you've probably heard the same rumors I have about Circuit of the Americas possibly being a part of the calendar. Have heard about an oval or two in the east, northeast, that might be in the frame. I'm not sure how much is going to happen there. Homestead, which I wrote about, I think, recently, was looking like, as of Road America, as the de facto replacement for Phoenix. And I even had one person in the series tell me basically it was a done deal. Wasn't saying it was truly done, but it had come that far to where they felt comfortable in saying that, yeah, you know, it looks like we're going. And that has apparently stopped altogether. So Homestead is off, which, I don't know about you, I have fond memories of racing there with teams. I don't have fond memories of going there and looking at the crowd size, which was pretty bad in the latter years.
Yeah, we've had some success there, and you know, I remember back when it was the mini Indy, the four corner track, which I loved. But you know, all the iterations of that track have had good racing, I think, and I think the current Indy cars would race well there. So it would be nice to go back there. But you're right, you know, it's hard to fill the seats, and Indy cars balancing television versus filling the seats. And the promoters, you know, they get their money by filling the seats, so I understand where they're coming from too. So it's a place I'd love to go back to. We've had some great races there, and I think it's you know, when we first went to Homestead, you wouldn't say it was a beautiful area of the country. When we first went there, about the only thing there was the Coast Guard air station,
a refinery right next to it.
Yeah, the Air Force base and the track, and the rest of the area pretty much been leveled by the hurricane. So the growth down there since then has been pretty amazing. And, you know, like I say, it's kind of like the Sonoma, Laguna thing. Hopefully someday the series is strong enough to where we can pull enough fans in to make it make sense for the promoter, because I think it would be a great place to race.
And I'll save a couple of other tidbits on Sears and Laguna and some of the other track-based stuff, because I know that we have a question or two, so I'll save some of the deeper insights for that. Let's look to maybe a little bit earlier than expected, but look to maybe wind down the part one of the Week in IndyCar here and start at least rounding turn three towards Q&A. So if we look at another milestone, I realize today, Chris, I don't know if Zach Veach has the little sign at home where you put the numbers of how many days since the last fire. But we're at 10 days for IndyCar's little fire starter without anything going up in flames. So we should definitely celebrate that milestone for him. Ha ha he he. On a more serious note, Mo Nunn. He'd been fighting Parkinson's with all of his strength for a couple years now, and had been in declining health for quite some time. Obviously very sad to learn of his passing today. At the same time, having witnessed whether it's parents or elderly folks going through hell with physical ailments, there's also that sense of possible relief that, okay, maybe you aren't having to go through this hell anymore, so maybe that is a blessing. Thinking of Mo, though, Chris, I know that you, as a championship-winning, top-tier Hall of Fame racing engineer, me as a custodian sweeping the floors in the Engineering Hall of Fame, whether you're someone at your end of the spectrum or my end of the spectrum, you have to look at Mo Nunn and think, good Lord, as someone, even a designer, but also a race engineer and then a team owner, this is just one of the titans of our sports that we have lost.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just an IndyCar, Formula One, driving himself back in the days. So it's a sad day for Chip Ganassi Racing, a sad day for IndyCar. I know it's a sad day for his family. And Mo gave my brother a ride in the 500. Was a big part of getting his IndyCar career going.
Yeah.
And a lot of other drivers, through the years. And, we have some, obviously plenty of people at Chip Ganassi Racing that worked with Morris. But even people that didn't work with him at Chip Ganassi Racing back then, worked with him at his own team. And now work with us. So a lot of friends through the paddock that know him, a lot of close ties to Morris. I never worked with him directly other than Chip and Mike brought him into to a couple of races back when things weren't so good back in 2005. And he was actually on the timing stand with us at Watkins Glen when Scott won there with the Toyota power, where we'd been struggling most of that season. So he was there kind of more as an observer, but it was interesting to see his viewpoint and the way he looked at things, for sure. And like you said, a titan of the sport, someone that's going to be missed. And our thoughts and prayers are with Catherine and Elliot and the rest of his family and their time of loss.
Of the many things I appreciated about Mo, although I did pay attention most of the time in high school and did later in life go to college, most of what I did in my career as a mechanic or otherwise was largely self-taught and or just was not something that was steeped in going to university or training courses and whatnot. And I always looked at Mo and appreciated what Mo did because he was the king of that, king of the self-taught person. And again, you don't have to go to university to be highly intelligent, but he was someone who always stood out to me as a guy that proved if you have the interest and the mental capacity and aptitude for such things, you can learn. You can be a Formula One chassis, designer, run your own team, be a championship-winning race engineer, and so on and so forth. just really almost a throwback to that I have a will and I am going to find a way. And when I walk into my trophy room, there is proof that this can be done. You can get to where I am without having to go through maybe some of the more traditional routes that have become popular these days at the upper echelons. Do you have an appreciation for that aspect of Mo as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we talk about it all the time when you know, we get people asking how do you get into engineering and or get onto a race team, and you know, it's probably harder now to do it without a college degree, but still, it's about so much of it is about experience and attitude, and being able to see a way forward that you're not going to look up in any book, and putting a lot of different pieces together. So yeah, Morris obviously was the epitome of that, and you know, he was, it's just the way he approached his life. Funny story that I've heard a few times around the CGR shop. I don't know if you know this, but Morris was a pretty avid golfer too.
Yeah.
And at one point he had one of the guys at the shop taking all of his golf balls and putting them in the MTS machine and checking the stiffness of the golf balls and rating them, putting them in order. So Morris knew which ones to use on which hole and on which course and all that. So it, you know, he approached his golf the same way he approaches racing. No detail left unturned.
I love it. I love it. Well, let's do this, Chris. Let's go ahead and say farewell to part one of the Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires and supported this month by Justice Brothers. And we will be right back with part two, Q&A, and we are going to cram in as many questions as possible before we have to let good old Pushy Loose go.